KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I will fight for a city that works for you, that is affordable for you, that is safe for you.
What can the Democratic Party learn from last night's victory of a progressive in New York City's mayoral primary?
It's Wednesday, June 25th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang. A new CIA statement says Iran's nuclear weapons program was, quote, severely damaged. But how much did bunker busters damage the critical site of Fordo?
It's cheaper and easier for someone to dig deeper than it is to penetrate through that depth.
Also, some students in Maine get the option of hiking outside instead of sitting in detention.
It makes me have to, like, walk. It makes you breathe heavily, obviously, and it feels like an accomplishment, almost.
And just in time for summer, NPR staffers pick their favorite fiction books from this year.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump, at the conclusion of the NATO summit in the Netherlands today, continued to insist U.S. strikes delivered a crushing blow to Iran's nuclear program. Initial assessments suggested less damage, but as NPR's Tamara Keith explains, the CIA has now weighed in with his own analysis.
Tonight, the White House circulated this statement from the CIA on social media. John Ratcliffe, the CIA director, said there's new intelligence from, quote, a historically reliable and accurate source or method that several key facilities were destroyed and it would take years to rebuild them, which is much closer to how President Trump has been describing it than other outside experts and that earlier assessment that leaked to journalists. Mm-hmm. I should say it is unusual for the CIA to put out any public statements on such sensitive matters. In addition, battle damage assessments can take many days or weeks, so it's unusual to have it so quickly.
NPR's Tamara Keith. Trump described the U.S. attack as, quote, obliterating critical Iranian nuclear facilities. A federal trade program for low-income young people will stay open, at least for now. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Morsbach reports a district judge in New York prevented a shutdown of Job Corps sites across the country today.
The U.S. Department of Labor cited budget deficits as a reason for closing the doors on over 120 Job Corps sites around the country last month. But supporters of the program sued. In a preliminary injunction order, Judge Andrew L. Carter Jr. says that the program was created and funded by Congress, and the Labor Department is, quote, not free to do as it pleases. Congress could still attempt to strip its funding in the budget. Supporters say that amid the uncertainty, Job Corps sites around the country have lost at least 30% of their students. For NPR News, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
In Colorado, a federal grand jury has indicted the Egyptian national accused of throwing Molotov cocktails at people in Boulder earlier this month. Colorado Public Radio's Allison Cherry has more.
Mohamed Suleiman is charged with a dozen counts, mostly hate crimes, for allegedly throwing firebombs at people peacefully trying to raise awareness for Israeli hostages on a pedestrian mall. Federal prosecutors say he targeted the group because he perceived them to be Zionist and because of their, quote, national origin. But in a court appearance last week, Suleiman's public defender says he targeted the group because of their politics, not their national origin. And politics is not covered under the federal hate crime law. The man also faces state criminal charges and remains in custody. For NPR News, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
A mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 106 points. The NASDAQ was up 61 points. This is NPR. Until recently, many New Yorkers had never heard of Zoran Mamdani, but that changed yesterday with his strong showing in the mayoral primary. The 33-year-old former foreclosure prevention specialist and state lawmaker from Queens posted a first-place showing in the Democratic primary. Mamdani declaring victory in yesterday's primary, he's seeking to become the city's first Muslim and Indian American mayor, not to mention the youngest New York mayor in generations. A centuries-old American musical tradition called shape note singing is about to get a big update. The Appalachia Mid-South Newsroom's Justin Hicks reports the most popular music book is getting a once-in-a-generation revision.
Shape note singing was popular in the United States before the Civil War. Today, there's still a thriving singing community, particularly in the South. This year, their most popular music book, The Sacred Harp, will be revised for the first time since 1991. David Ivey led the committee for the Sacred Harp Publishing Company. It decided which old tunes to remove and which new tunes to incorporate.
Hopefully, you'd think my great-grandfather hear that hymn and he would say, oh, that sounds just like something you'd want to sing in the first part of the 20th century.
Shape Note singers are planning to release the book at a gathering in September. Many expect it could be the largest attended singing in their lifetime. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks in Benton, Kentucky.
Crude oil futures prices bounced back a bit today amid new data showing continued strong U.S. demand heading into the peak summer driving season. Oil up nearly 1% to $64.92 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. 33-year-old Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani has declared victory in the Democratic primary for mayor of New York City. At a time when the Democratic brand is facing deep unpopularity with voters, Mamdani's success is notable. But what, if anything, does it say about the direction of the party as a whole? Well, NPR's Stephen Fowler has been reporting on that very question since last year's election and joins us now. Hi, Stephen.
Hey there.
Okay, let's start with last night. What do we first need to know about the dynamics of this specific primary in this specific race to understand Mamdani's victory?
First up, it is important to reiterate this is one data point from one race in one city that primarily should not be extrapolated out to the national electorate as a whole, let alone the whole spectrum of Democrats.
Fair.
Mamdani ran a grassroots campaign that was very charismatic, compelling, and laser-focused on issues his campaign bet were most salient with voters. Here's an excerpt of his victory speech Tuesday night.
I will fight for a city that works for you, that is affordable for you, that is safe for you. I will work to be a mayor you will be proud to call your own.
Also, the incumbent Democratic mayor Eric Adams is unpopular and running as an independent, and the longtime frontrunner, supported by many Democratic establishment figures, former Governor Andrew Cuomo, had a lot of baggage from his time in office, including how he handled the COVID pandemic and sexual harassment allegations.
Okay, right. Beyond those caveats, though, is there anything under the surface in this one race that can help explain the broader state of the Democratic Party right now? What do you think?
Well, a lot of those establishment Democrats that endorsed Andrew Cuomo, people like former President Bill Clinton and South Carolina Democratic Representative Jim Clyburn, also included many who called for him to resign just 4 years ago at a time when Democratic-aligned voters are not happy with said establishment. You're also seeing that with a flurry of young primary challengers popping up in House races with older incumbents, made even more urgent by several older Democrats dying in office. I also talked with Tom Jensen of Public Policy Polling, a firm affiliated with the Democratic Party, and one of the few that seemed to capture momentum for Mamdani ahead of the election because of a surge of turnout in voters under 45 and people that hadn't voted before. Also, he said Mamdani had a type of personal magnetism that Democratic candidates can replicate regardless of their ideology.
I think you can have that from a Democratic Socialist perspective, but I think you can also have that from a moderate perspective. It's more about how you communicate with voters and that sort of thing than necessarily what your positions are on all the issues.
I mean, Jensen also said that type of magnetism reminds him of Barack Obama in 2008.
Okay, well, Stephen, let's just be very direct here. I mean, the Democratic Party is unpopular right now. It's out of power. Many people feel that it has not been able to effectively message opposition to President Trump's policies. Where do you think they go from here?
Well, there are things that the president's pushing that voters don't like, especially some of the specific ways Trump has sought to enforce immigration laws. Mamdani's victory speech positioned his vision for the mayor of New York City as someone who will, quote, use the power to reject Donald Trump's fascism. And, you know, there are other Democrats that are similar messengers that are gaining more popularity.
That is NPR's Stephen Fowler. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
A political opposition leader from Belarus is out of prison after 5 years. Sergei Tikhanovsky was a blogger and activist who opposed Alexander Lukashenko's government. And when he announced his plan to run for president, the regime arrested him, along with thousands of dissidents who protested in the streets against Lukashenko's three-decade rule. His wife, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, is now the leader of the opposition government and is in exile. She was just at this year's NATO summit at The Hague and joins us from Amsterdam. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Hello.
The last time you spoke to us in 2023, you had not heard your husband's voice in almost 3 years. And here's what you told us.
The only chance to send my love to him is through a lawyer who visits him once a week.
And now your husband is free. So tell us about the moment you were reunited.
You know, this moment was very emotional. After 5 long years, I finally hugged my husband. But you can't not thinking about all those who stay behind bars till now.
Do you know why he was released now when officially he still had many years left to serve?
My husband was released in the result of efforts of the United States of America, State Department, President Trump. It's not the first release on this venue. And this time General Kellogg came to Minsk. And I think it was like, you know, payment of Lukashenko for this public visit.
You mentioned General Kellogg, that's Trump's envoy for Russia and Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, who visited Lukashenko, which was a stark change in policy from the Biden administration, which tried to isolate and sanction the regime. Do you think Trump's involvement is a positive development in the region?
Look, we are grateful for to President Trump for his attempts to negotiate about peace in Ukraine, because victory of Ukraine is extremely essential for all our region and the fate of Belarus and Ukraine intertwined. But of course, our position here is clear that Lukashenko serves to Putin's interest. He is co-aggressor in the war. He cannot be trusted. For Lukashenko, this meeting was extremely important because he wants to legitimize himself. He wants to normalize relationship with the democratic world. But we need to keep this pressure on the regime because we see repressions are continuing.
Now that your husband, who used to lead the opposition, is free, you have been leading the opposition for the last 5 years. How do you see the next chapter going forward?
We will strengthen each other. We are not going to compete. Just imagine a person who spent 5 years in isolation. He haven't a clue what was going on these 5 years. He needs time, you know, to realize how we are working, what's our structures, how we organized. So then it will him who will decide his future track.
Just on a personal level, your husband says he was tortured and kept in solitary confinement for years. You and he and your family have changed in the time that he's been away. How do you both pick up the pieces and recover what was lost from all those years apart?
What for me is important that my children have this pillar in our family. I look at my older son, he's 15 now, and I think that all these 5 years he had huge burden on his shoulders that he's the only man in our family, and he took this responsibility for his like women, younger sister and mother, and it was so difficult emotionally for him. And I look on him now, he's just a little bit relief. And my younger daughter, who saw daddy at 4, she might even don't remember, you know, this father-daughter relationship, you know. And it's so interesting to see how they knowing each yeah. other like from scratch. So the only problem I have to cook twice more now.
It's a nice problem to have. That's Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, leader of the opposition government in Belarus, now living in Lithuania with her husband, Sergei, who was just released after 5 years in prison. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Anyone who has broken school rules has probably spent some time in detention, you know, a few hours stuck in a classroom monitored by a teacher who doesn't want to be there either. But one counselor at Morse High School in Maine is taking students out into nature instead. Maine Public's Maddie Smith tagged along on one of the last hikes of the year.
It's a sunny, almost 70-degree day, and counselor at Morse High School, Leslie Trundy, stops in front of a trail map in Bath, Maine.
We're right here, and so we're going to follow the Wiskig Trail, and we're going to go through the cemetery.
She explains the route that her seven students will follow for the next 2 hours.
We kind of take a side shoot here, so we make a loop, but we'll come back along the river, and then we'll come back. We should be back by 4 to the school.
The students are serving detention for an array of infractions.
I yelled at a teacher rudely because I didn't feel like doing something, and when they tried to make me do it, I got angry and yelled at them.
Probably like skipping class or like added up tardies from class, like never like actually like getting in trouble.
Playing video games in my teacher's class, and she got mad at me, and I found that one stupid, so I was like, I'm not sitting in the classroom for that.
Nicholas Tangway, Elsie Nelson-Walling, and Wyatt Wells have all joined multiple detention hikes this year. Trundy began the program after attending an outdoor education conference. She wondered whether spending time outdoors might encourage the kids to open up about the problems they might be experiencing.
My hope was that time in the woods, like I could sort of take the skills that I have on the road with them or on the trail and be a listener for them and pay back the time to the school and sort of serve their consequence, but also receive more care and attention.
Trundy says some parents have refused to let their kids take part. And so she's fielded some criticism from those who don't believe that a walk in the woods is enough punishment for making poor choices. But Trundy says that isn't necessarily the case for those that choose to hike.
Sometimes the hike feels really like a punishment for them, even though they've chosen it. Like they might have chosen it because it was a lessening sentence, but it did feel like they were having to expend effort.
No, you did this right here.
Freshman Nicholas Tangway says that expended effort is good for his mental health. And he dreads detention less, knowing he gets to hike instead of just sitting in a classroom.
It makes me have to like walk. It makes you breathe heavily, obviously, and it feels like an accomplishment almost.
At the end of the 3.5-mile hike, the students grab their backpacks and head home. Trundy says she intends to start up the optional hike program again next school year.
I'm so curious if some of the freshmen that I've started hiking with this year, are they still hiking with me when they're seniors on detention, or are they hiking an outing club? Like, these students could, I see this leadership potential in a lot of them.
Trundy says she invites students to join the outdoor outing club every hike, and at least 3 students have joined after going on a detention hike this year. For NPR News, I'm Maddie Smith in Bath, Maine.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Let's look at how law enforcement here in the U.S. is preparing for possible retaliation by Iran for American strikes on nuclear facilities. Iran already fired missiles at a U.S. base in Qatar, and a shaky ceasefire with Israel is holding for now. Still, federal authorities are on alert. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is here to explain what they're watching for. Hey, Ryan.
Hi there.
When you talk to federal authorities about this, what do they tell you is their main concern?
Well, look, this is something that they're definitely keeping a close eye on. The Department of Homeland Security put out a bulletin after the U.S. strike on Iran, warning of what DHS called a heightened threat environment. It says there are no specific credible threats at the moment, but there is concern about Iranian hackers potentially targeting computer networks in the U.S. or for violence, including violence directed at the Jewish community here. The FBI and DHS, meanwhile, had a call with state and local law enforcement officials over the weekend, advising them to be on a higher state of alert for potential threats from Iran.
In the past, Iran has also been accused of plotting against U.S. government officials. Is that a concern right now?
Certainly, there's a precedent for Iran doing that in response specifically to U.S. military action. During Trump's first term, the U.S. killed a top Iranian general in a drone strike. Just days later, Iran retaliated by firing ballistic missiles at U.S. bases in Iraq. But it didn't stop there. It was patient. It took its time. More than a year later, according to American officials, Iran began targeting senior American political and military officials for assassination right here on U.S. soil.
Right. I remember Justice Department prosecutors have said one of those alleged targets was John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor in his first term.
That's right. It was in 2022 that the Justice Department brought a case against a suspected Iranian government operative for allegedly plotting to assassinate Bolton. The feds, of course, foiled that scheme, as they did others, including one that the Justice Department said just this past November that it had disrupted that was targeting Trump. Now, former officials tell me that the U.S. has traditionally been a difficult place for Iranian operatives to work in these alleged plots and others that Iran is allegedly behind targeting dissidents here in the U.S. Iran security services have had to essentially try to farm out the work, usually to criminals of one stripe or another. Those folks haven't always been particularly competent, but the threat is still very much real. The U.S. government certainly has taken it seriously. For years, it provided security for the former American officials who were targeted by Iran. Worth pointing out, though, that Trump revoked security for most of those folks after he returned to office.
What is the FBI doing today to address the concerns you've described?
Well, the FBI says that its assets are fully engaged and that it's remaining vigilant. But I spoke with Christopher O'Leary. He's a former senior FBI counterterrorism official. And what he said is that in this sort of situation, the FBI will be keeping a close eye and a close ear on any folks with ties to Iran who are already under investigation, keeping tabs on their movements, their communications, to make sure that the FBI knows what they're up to. But O'Leary says that in the past few days, FBI leadership has been shifting resources to address potential threats from Iran. And he says that can't be a short-term thing.
The resources and the attention professionalism that's needed to work these very sophisticated cases has to be there permanently, enduring. I mean, this is not something that's just going to go away.
O'Leary and other experts say Iran is a sophisticated actor. It traditionally does not respond in a knee-jerk manner. So there's a need, he says, for diligence here on the part of U.S. authorities.
And NPR's Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
In Peru, going to school can be dangerous. As John Otis reports, criminals demanding extortion payments are threatening to blow up schools and kill their teachers.
At this Catholic elementary school on the ramshackle outskirts of Lima, students are rambunctious and seemingly carefree. By contrast, school administrators are stressing out. This one tells me that gangsters are demanding that the school pay them 100,000 Peruvian soles, or about $28,000. They send us messages saying they know where we live, says the administrator, who requested anonymity because he fears retribution from the gangs. They send us photos of grenades and pistols. These are not empty threats. A few weeks ago, he says, police arrested a teenager in the pay of a criminal gang as he planted a bomb at the entrance to the school. Schools in Peru are easy targets for extortion. Due to the poor quality of public education, thousands of private schools have sprung up. Many are located in poor barrios dominated by criminals, who are now demanding a cut of their tuition fees. Miriam Ramirez, president of one of Lima's largest parent-teacher associations, says at least 1,000 schools are being blackmailed. To reduce the threat to students, some schools have switched to online classes, but at least five have closed down. If this keeps up, Ramirez says, the country is going to end up in total ignorance. Extortion is part of a broader crime wave in Peru that gained traction during the COVID-19 pandemic. Peru also saw a huge influx of Venezuelan migrants, including members of the Tren de Aragua criminal group. Francisco Rivadeneira, a former Peruvian police commander, says corrupt cops are part of the problem. In exchange for bribes, he says, officers tip off gangs about pending police raids. NPR reached out to the Peruvian police for comment, but there was no response. Political instability has made things worse. Due to corruption scandals, Peru has gone through six presidents in just the past 9 years. In March, current president Dina Boluarte ordered the army into the streets to help fight crime, but it's made a little difference. Extortionists now operate in the poorest patches of Lima. They target hole-in-the-wall bodegas, street-side empanada stands, and even soup kitchens, like this one in the squatter settlement of Villa Maria. Genoveva Huatarango, who helps prepare 100 meals per day for the needy, says thugs stabbed one of her workers, then left a note demanding weekly payments.
Parece que paga semanalmente 50 soles.
To avoid similar attacks, Huatarango says, nearby soup kitchens now pay the gangsters $14 per week. But there is some pushback. After its front gate was dynamited in March, the San Vicente School in North Lima hired private security guards. Violeta Upangi, whose 13-year-old daughter studies here, says the children were told to go to class in street clothes rather than school uniforms. That's to avoid being identified as San Vicente students and attacked by the gangs. Still, many schools have buckled to their demands.
La misma policía en este caso nos indica que negociemos con los señores.
The administrator at the Catholic elementary school says his colleagues reported extortion threats to the police. But instead of going after the gangs, he says, the police recommended that the school pay them off for their own safety. That's why, he says, the school ended up forking over the equivalent of $14,000. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Lima, Peru.
This is NPR News.
President Trump has a lot on his plate. His budget bill, the heart of his domestic agenda, is facing pushback in the Senate as lawmakers face a July 4th deadline to pass it. The president has another deadline to unpause double-digit tariffs on more than 60 countries. And that's not all. He's also dealing with a conflict between Iran and Israel, one which he chose to intervene in. So how is Trump dealing with all that pressure? That story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, a book of religious music from 1844 is getting an upgrade.
It involves a traditional style of American music called shape note singing.
They could not hold a tune in a bucket, but they're accepted, they're valued, and that's just part of it.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dwayne Brown. NATO says its commitment to Ukraine is not wavered, but President Zelensky had a smaller role at this week's summit. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley tells us at previous NATO summits, Zelensky has been a central focus.
As one analyst put it, Zelensky had a fold-out chair at this summit, though NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte did announce $39 billion in European funding for Ukraine in the first half of this year.
We stand by Ukraine in its pursuit of peace and will continue to support Ukraine on its irreversible path to NATO membership.
In his press conference, President Trump changed the topic when a reporter asked why he hadn't stopped the war in Ukraine, though he did say Zelensky was extremely cordial in their meeting.
Couldn't have been nicer, actually, but I took from the meeting that he'd like to see it end.
Trump said the war is more complicated than people realize, and Russian President Vladimir Putin is more difficult than he thought. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, The Hague.
A monthly poll by the American Psychiatric Association says a majority of respondents believe climate change is hurting mental health. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee tells us the poll also found younger people were more likely to recognize the impact than older adults.
The poll surveyed more than 2,000 adults across the country. 55% of those respondents said they believe climate change is adversely affecting Americans' mental health. More than 40% said they were personally affected. One in three said they worry about climate change on a weekly basis and that it's a significant source of stress for them. 18 to 34-year-olds were significantly more likely compared to those 65 and older to report that they feel personally affected and feel anxious about governmental response to climate change. Parents were also more likely than non-parents to report the same. Only 4% of respondents said they don't believe climate change exists. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR. There were some violent confrontations between police and protesters in Kenya today, with reports of several people injured. NPR's Michael Koloki has more.
Thousands of people have taken to the streets in cities and towns across the country. In several areas, police engaged protesters in running battles, with reports of buildings and vehicles set ablaze in some localities. Here in the capital, Nairobi, several businesses remained closed while transport was paralyzed in a number of neighborhoods. The protests were held to mark the one-year anniversary of deadly demonstrations that took place in the country against a tax bill the government had introduced. In addition to the commemorative protests, members of the country's political opposition laid wreaths outside the Kenyan Parliament building in memory of the scores of people killed during the demonstrations last year. For NPR News, I'm Michael Koloki in Nairobi.
Europeans remain angry with Tesla CEO Elon Musk and still aren't buying his electric vehicles. Tesla sales dropped for a fifth month in a row in May, even as the overall market for EVs in Europe expanded sharply. Tesla sales plunged 28% last month in 30 European countries, despite Musk promising a major rebound. The Tesla billionaire angered many Europeans when he embraced far-right-wing politicians during recent elections there. On Wall Street, stocks finished mixed today. The Dow lost more than 100 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A federal judge in Washington State has ordered the Trump administration to resume distributing money to build electric vehicle chargers. Those funds were allocated by Congress during the Biden administration, but largely frozen since February. NPR's Camila Domonoske has been covering this and joins us now. Hi, Camila.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us more about this money that's being fought over here.
We're talking about a $5 billion program, which was set up in the bipartisan infrastructure law that passed in 2021. Mm-hmm. And these funds were meant for building specifically high-speed electric vehicle chargers along highways. So the kind of thing that people are looking for on road trips.
Totally.
Because range anxiety on those road trips, we know, is a huge concern for people who are considering electric vehicles, and the Biden administration wanted to address it. There are a lot of private chargers that are being built, not with federal dollars, but this money was specifically meant to plug in gaps where maybe a company wouldn't think it was going to be profitable to build a charger, but it would be useful for drivers.
Okay, so that was the goal of this program. What actually happened?
Well, first, it was slow to roll out the money, which meant that there was a lot of this that hadn't been spent yet by the time President Trump was inaugurated and immediately started pulling a U-turn on EVs, including specifically reversing course on charger funding. So then the Department of Transportation said that it was going to pause this program while it rewrote the rules for this spring, but they never actually announced any new rules, and the money just stayed frozen. So more than a dozen states challenged this, and a judge in this order sided with the states and said, yes, the administration could certainly change the rules for how the program is administered going forward, but they have to keep distributing money for projects that are already underway.
Okay, so is the case anywhere near over? My guess is no.
Yeah, not by a long shot. Your guess is correct. This is a temporary injunction as the case moves forward. And in fact, this injunction is not even in effect yet. There was a delay built in to give the administration a chance to appeal. Still, it's a win for the states. California's attorney general said that he's pleased. The Sierra Club said this is just the first step. The Department of Transportation, in a statement emailed to NPR, said, quote, another day, another liberal judicial activist making nonsensical rulings from the bench because they hate President Trump, end quote. That statement also called the program overall a disaster and said the department is assessing its legal options and working to reform this program.
Okay. Well, Camila, of course, this is not the only example of the Trump administration freezing funds and a court stepping in to block it. Like, we've seen this with federal grants and loans, foreign aid, and now with EV chargers. So can you just talk about the pattern that you see playing out here?
Yeah, there has been a whole series of legal challenges that are all about the separation of powers, the fact that it's Congress that's supposed to make decisions about spending, not the executive branch, not the president, not an individual agency. So the judge in Washington State here, Tara Lynn, wrote that when the executive branch treads upon the will of the legislative branch, it's the court's responsibility to restore the balance of power. So Congress passed a law, they said this money should be spent for this purpose, and now this administration has been not spending it.
That is NPR's Camila Domonoske. Thank you so much, Camila.
Thank you, Elsa.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
President Trump said again today that an American strike had devastated a key Iranian nuclear facility deep inside a mountain.
It was called obliteration. No other military on earth could have done it.
Trump says obliteration, and in a new statement, CIA Director John Ratcliffe says the overall weapons program was, quote, severely damaged. But others in the intelligence community seem less sure. One earlier classified assessment says with low confidence that the strike may have done only limited damage to one key facility. Joining me to discuss what we know is NPR science and security correspondent Jeff Brumfiel. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ari.
In the run-up to these strikes, the thinking was that only American bombs could reach this facility called Fordo. Are we now learning that maybe not even they could do the job?
Well, it's true American bombs were the only ones with a shot at it, and in particular this 30,000-pound precision-guided bunker buster. So America delivered a dozen of them by B-2 stealth bomber, and satellite imagery suggests the strike was perfectly executed by the pilots. The bombs were dropped in these tight clusters in two parts of the site, one likely directly above Fordo's uranium centrifuges, and the other was probably a ventilation shaft that would have been a potential vulnerability. But even though the military conducted the strike flawlessly, it might not have worked, and the reason comes down to geology.
What's so special about the geology?
So, in some sense, this is the simplest physics imaginable. You have a really big bomb, and it hits the ground, and how far it goes into the ground depends on a couple of factors. A big one is how hard the ground is. I spoke to Raymond Johnlow, a scientist at the University of California, Berkeley, who was part of a study on bunker busters nearly 20 years ago. Here's what he said.
It depends enormously on the kind of rock.
And natural voids and fractures in the rock can also have a huge effect, scattering the energy of the bomb. Today, President Trump actually said that the U.S. believed the rock was made of granite. That, of course, is pretty hard. And we know the Iranians dug their tunnels as deep as they could. Johnlow says that this is a basic problem for all bunker buster weapons.
It's cheaper and easier for someone to dig deeper than it is to penetrate through that depth.
Again, this mission appears to have been perfectly executed, but they never tried it before, and it's possible it just didn't work.
The intelligence assessment we have is early. There's likely going to be more information coming out. But what are the consequences if this was not a success and it did not take out this nuclear site?
Well, Fordo is an important site to the Iranians, to be sure. But every expert I've spoken to so far agrees that, honestly, it may not matter. There's no way to completely eliminate Iran's nuclear program with bombs. There are just too many other facilities, too many places to hide equipment and uranium. Here's Chris Ford. He was a former Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation during the first Trump administration.
If you really want to have reasonable confidence in a solution over time, you need to have an agreement with some kind of cooperative verification and ongoing monitoring.
In other words, regardless of whether Fordo was destroyed, the U.S. still needs to make some sort of nuclear deal with Iran if it wants to be sure it's not going to get a bomb. And Trump said there are plans to meet with the Iranians next week, but he doesn't seem to care if the two sides reach an agreement.
NPR's Jeff Brumfiel, thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A federal judge in Tennessee today has ordered Kilmar Abrego Garcia to be released from prison until his trial on federal charges. This is the man the government mistakenly deported to a notorious prison in El Salvador. He was ordered returned to the U.S., but as of today, it's uncertain whether he will go to trial. Mariana Bacquiao from WPLN was in court where there's been a series of developments, and she joins us now. Hi, Mariana.
Hi.
Okay, so what happened in federal court today?
Well, this hearing was mainly about the judge setting conditions for Abrego Garcia's release. Over the weekend, Judge Barbara Holmes, a federal judge in Nashville, denied the government's ask to keep him in jail until his trial. Now, in a usual trial, this would just be the judge setting conditions, like where the defendant can travel, whether they can access firearms, things like that. And we did get that. The judge determined that Abrego Garcia would only be able to travel between his home state of Maryland and parts of Tennessee where his trial is being held. She also mandated anger management counseling. That's in response to the government's case to keep him in jail. Prosecutors talked about protective orders that Abrego Garcia's wife had filed. She's since rescinded them, and she's talked about how they're in a much better place now, and she just wants to see him home.
Okay, but what are the specific charges that Abrego Garcia is facing?
Federal prosecutors charged him with human smuggling. They say that for several years, Abrego Garcia transported thousands of migrants without legal status across the U.S. starting in 2016. Abrego Garcia has pleaded not guilty to those charges. The government also accuses him of being a member of the MS-13 street gang. Abrego Garcia's lawyers argue the charges are just a distraction from the fact that the government hasn't afforded him due process. Judge Holmes herself has expressed quite a bit of skepticism about the government's case.
So what happened today after the hearing concluded?
Well, the big question was whether Abrego Garcia would be taken into ICE custody after the hearing. I saw a few Department of Homeland Security vehicles parked outside the courthouse before the hearing began. There were a few agents standing by outside. But the judge has delayed his release by a few days, although a U.S. Marshal told me that ICE will likely just take him into custody whenever he's officially released. But, you know, ICE's presence wasn't really a surprise for either party. In the judge's discussion of this case, she acknowledged that Abrego Garcia will likely remain in ICE custody regardless of her decision, and that it's possible he'd be subject to federal removal proceedings. She said there wasn't much she could do about that, adding that it falls outside of her court's jurisdiction. But she said this hearing on his pretrial release is part of the due process Abrego Garcia is guaranteed.
Okay, so if Abrego Garcia ends up back in federal custody, what does that mean for him, essentially?
Well, there are a lot of questions, including whether he'll be able to stand trial or whether the government will move to deport him before that happens. Today, the judge did ask the U.S. Attorney's Office to cooperate with DHS and make sure that Abrego Garcia will be available for his court dates. But the prosecution says they're not in charge of what ICE ultimately does, and that could mean he's deported before his trial even starts. Either way you look at it, it seems Abrego Garcia is in a very difficult place legally.
That is Mariana Bacallao from WPLN. Thank you, Mariana.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. So if you are not sure what to prioritize in that to-be-read stack, well, we have called in some reinforcements. The NPR Books team has just put out its list of NPR staff favorites that have been published this year so far. Andrew Limbong, the host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast, is here with some fiction recommendations. Hey, Andrew.
Reinforcements are in. reporting for duty, Elsa. Ready to go.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your service.
Yeah.
All right. It's summertime. Give me something fun to read, even if I have a margarita coursing through my bloodstream.
Okay, all right. What do we got that's fun on this list? There's this new John Scalzi novel called When the Moon Hits Your Eye.
Ow.
Yeah. Nice. I like what you did there. It's a sci-fi book that asks this brave question. What if the moon turned into cheese? Right?
All right. Yeah,
okay, all right. So the ramifications of this happening are actually quite serious, but the book does come to terms with this looming apocalypse. Some might call it a cheesepocalypse, right, if you will. You like that one?
That's good.
But, it's a funny and biting, and it's also like a charming satire on how we as a society deal with like major events, which is to say, not great.
Not great at all.
Yeah.
Okay, that is definitely something to read if you are tipsy. That is sci-fi. But Andrew, what I am really here for is the romance section. So give me something juicy.
All right, so I'm a born and raised New Yorker, and I've personally never thought about the Staten Island Ferry as a particularly romantic place to meet someone. I mean, whatever floats your boat, literally. Right? It is the setting of the book Promise Me Sunshine by Cara Bestone. And it's about a woman named Lenny who's dealing with like the grief of losing her best friend. And she spends her time sort of taking the Staten Island ferry back and forth. And she eventually meets this guy named Miles who, is kind of a grump and is a little blunt, but he's a good guy under all that tough exterior, right? You see where this is going.
Right.
It's a slower burn romance that kind of takes this time to get going, but it really digs into this idea of like support, right? What we need when we need someone, not necessarily just for romantic reasons, but also for just a shoulder to cry on.
So it's a journey into empathy.
Yeah.
All right, that sounds very sweet. Well, what's a book that you think we will still be talking about, like, in December?
Yeah, come year-end lists.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to cheat and pick two, only because these are two writers working in genre fiction that I think have put out some of their most highly acclaimed books this year. One is S.A. Cosby's book, King of Ashes. It's a Southern Gothic crime thriller about a family who runs a crematorium. And somehow this crematorium gets entangled in a local gang. Cosby writes this sort of like hard-boiled fiction, right? So there's sex and violence and drugs. But he gives it a historical weight of the small Virginia towns he usually sets his books in. The other writer I wanted to mention was Stephen Graham Jones. He's a pretty prolific horror writer. And his latest book, The Buffalo Hunter Hunter, has gotten a lot of buzz since it came out. It's a historical horror revenge novel that involves like vampires and indigenous history and religion. Based on the reaction to these two books coming out, I think they each have a shot at being seen as like each of these authors like Abbey Roads or OK Computers, it's just the culmination of an artist at the peak of their powers putting out what may be seen as their best work yet.
Those sound cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about like your ultimate pick? What is the one book that you just cannot stop thinking about?
All right. I want to shout out this book called Tilt by Emma Patti. The author, she was actually on the show when this book came out, and it's about an extremely pregnant woman who has to go on a last-minute trip to IKEA when an earthquake hits, right? She has to traverse all this rubble to get back home. And the premise is super simple, super bare bones, right? She just has to get from point A to point B, and it's like written and paced like an action thriller. But there's a lot of deep and touching meditation about motherhood and class and the sort of like keeping up with the Joneses of early parenthood.
Wow, all inside an IKEA.
All inside IKEA.
That was Andrew Limbong, host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks, Elsa.
People who perform a traditional style of American music called shape note singing are publishing a new edition of music and planning a gathering to celebrate and, of course, sing. AMSN's Justin Hicks reports singers are hotly anticipating this once-in-a-generation event.
In the small town of Benton, Kentucky, a few dozen people recently gathered to participate in the 142nd annual Big Singing. The town claims it's the oldest indigenous musical tradition in the U.S. and it preserves a uniquely American style of a cappella music called shape note singing. They're singing from a book called The Sacred Harp. Notes are printed with odd shapes like diamonds and triangles on the musical staff, and when it's sung, there's usually no audience. Everyone faces each other in a giant square and takes turns leading songs from the middle. It was popular in the early 1800s, especially in rural areas where music education was rare.
It is a method to teach people how to sing when you don't have an instrument.
That's Tim Reynolds, a longtime shape note singer who traveled to the singing from Nashville, Tennessee. He says even though the text of the songs are based on old Christian themes, these days, shape note groups aren't really religious. They're more about building community. Case in point, Reynolds says some longtime singers aren't even very good.
And they could not hold a tune in a bucket, but they're accepted, they're valued, and that's just part of it.
And now, shape note singers have something big to look forward to. The Sacred Harp is getting an update. John Plunkett is the chair of the Sacred Harp Publishing Company. It's a small nonprofit that's printed the music for nearly a century.
The book was originally published in 1844, and it's been revised every 25 to 35 years since that time. The current book that we're using came out in the early 90s. So it's just time.
Plunkett says each time the Sacred Harp is revised, less popular tunes get removed and new compositions are added. Those edits keep the small but passionate shape note community alive, not frozen in history like a reenactment.
I think all of us feel sort of a weighty responsibility.
That's David Ivey. He's in charge of a 9-member committee that sorted through nearly 1,200 compositions from shape note singers with new tunes and new lyrics. Ivey says a big criteria for him is that the songs have a traditional sound, not just a Taylor Swift song in shape note form.
You'll think, was that written 20 years ago, or was it written 120 years ago, or 220 years ago?
Jerusalem, my happy home.
So which tunes will make it into the new book? Ivy says that's top secret. Everyone will find out at the same time in September, when the new Sacred Harp is released. They're expecting hundreds for a special singing in Atlanta with the new book. It's expected to be the largest shape note gathering in a generation. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks in Benton, Kentucky.
I see home, sweet home, my folks at home, my home.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is...